JJ Cornish is well known to anyone who's listened to my show over the years, and in fact to many other shows where he's been a regular contributor on All Affairs African. African Analysis is what we do with him every 2 weeks. But he's also someone who has experienced firsthand elections in a number of countries. He'll tell us how many in just a moment. And since this is Democracy 101, we thought it would be a good idea to find out from JJ what actually happens when you're an election observer, what that entails, how it comes about that he ended up being an election observer, and what he has observed. So straight over to the man who's found himself in 14 countries, JJ?
No fewer than 14 as an observer.
That's very impressive. I mean, that's a CV.
Well, and I absolutely love it. At least I'm counting now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of those, I've been with this organization, and a very, very enviable organization it is too, called EISA, E-I-S-A, set up to observe our elections, our first democratic election in 1994. Electoral Institute for South Africa. It did such a bang-up job that other countries said, come along, can you do this? And I mean, I've shared observation with all sorts of regional groupings and with the Carter Institute, Jimmy Carter. Right. Whatever failings he might have had as president, he certainly, his legacy is as the organization that looks after, that observes elections around the world, and we've done joint operations with them. But it's a very interesting task that they undertake, and they've changed their name now to the the Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Africa.
All right,
effectively.
So I mean, what is an observer, and what are you required to do when you're observing elections in these countries?
Well, the interesting thing is there's three main jobs, and I've always done the shorter one, taking about 2 weeks. You pitch up. And as a journalist, it's fantastic, Gareth, because you then get to see the real heavy hitters, the movers and shakers, come to brief you.
Right.
As a journalist, you would never get access to these people.
Yeah.
I've never lied about it. I've always told the ICE has always known that I'm a journalist, that I've been reporting on it, and I've got away with it. I'll tell you stories about that, though. But ICE always also set up the ground rules for elections. They published a book called PEMO,
yeah.
Principles for Election Management, Monitoring, and Observation.
Okay.
Now, often governments don't like you to be called an observer, so your little badge will say that you're an election monitor.
Oh.
It's sort of semantics. But nonetheless, it's very interesting. And then they've broken the election down into three parts. The pre-election, which is the registration of voters, political parties registration, the nomination, the delimitation. Now, the delimitation is something that we have. That's the making the boundaries of the constituencies, you see.
Okay.
Now,
yeah.
That was something that the National Party, the NATA in South Africa, cheated at enormously.
Gerrymandering.
You've took the words right out of my mouth. It's an Irish word.
Yeah.
And anything that involves cheating in elections is normally Irish in extract.
Well,
they use Irish
I hate to say it, but America should ask you to come and observe their elections at the end of this year, because they do a lot of gerrymandering too.
Well, I can remember one particular example was Hillbrow. I don't know how many people lived there, and it was for a guy called Jacobs.
Yeah.
And he changed parties. He changed from the United Party to the National Party at one point, finally. But he was a war hero, and I don't know how many tens of thousands of voters he had in Hillbrow. But, you know, there was another constituency, Wakkerstroom, that had maybe not even a full 1,000, you know, and they were both seats in Parliament. So that gerrymandering was evident there. Interestingly, that Jacobs, when he missed parties, I was in Parliament at the time, and somebody stood up and called him a twee gat Jacobs, and I thought, that cannot be parliamentary. But, of course, I was thinking anatomically. They were thinking they were thinking strategically where his lair is.
Yeah, correct.
But
anyway, two holes.
So I'm going through the pre-election post, the campaign, you look at people, are people allowed to come, the media, is the media given fair access, and is the official media biased one way or another? The use of public resources. Does the government use public money to fight its election? Violence and intimidation. Really important that. Are the security forces involved? I've got something to say about that on a particular case later. And the political parties, how are they financed? And then another very important one is voter education. And I saw that. I covered the first democratic elections. I was observer there for the Congo. I've been there now 3 or 4 times now.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see, Gareth, between the first and the second polling, how Congolese, who had not, 2 generations had not had elections, suddenly knew a hell of a lot about how to vote, where to go, and the strategy of voting. And that's voter education, absolutely essential. Then the second one is the actual election day, and that's the one that I would have done, you know, and the bigger group of people. They invite NGOs and representatives of political parties and so on, and basically they have to get the money, at least to pay us a small per diem and to pay for this operation, flying people there, moving them around there. That's the polling stations. You go to the polling station, you go before the time, you see them opening the ballot boxes. I only know the French name for that, the urne, the ballot boxes. Do they show it to people? Are they empty? When they seal them, do they open the poll on time? That sort of thing. The secrecy of the ballot, you know, there's curtains and yes, all of that. The papers, do they have enough voting papers? Are the boxes, as I said, secured? Other voting materials? And then the counting process. They wouldn't let us into the counting process in Zimbabwe.
I wonder why.
I see you reel back in shock, but
no, this is fascinating stuff because
that's
when
the day.
That's the day, right? So I mean, we think about South Africa, and we've luckily had the IEC in here a couple of times, and they have told us about all the processes that they go through to make sure that people have faith in the integrity of the elections.
Yeah.
And obviously, inviting foreigners who are willing participants as observers, it gives it credibility.
It certainly does. Interestingly, our first, our second, and I do believe our third election, was it our third? We had observers, international observers. Yeah. And I mean, the people that I speak to in all sorts of United Nations people, I go to the Western Sahara and this guy said, oh, I remember South Africa. I was in Kai River for the oil elections, and you know, and people remember them as very, very successful elections. But interestingly, when we didn't have observers, the media said, "Well, how about that? They're not even interested in us anymore." And I remember saying, "You know, not having foreign election observers at your election is a good thing. It means that it's like not having Christiana Amanpour visit your country.
Right.
It's a good thing.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Because if you don't feel that you have to observe it internationally, we cannot trust that election.
So
we have to have election observers. So when they didn't have them, I said it was a good thing. People still said, oh, they should have taken more interest. Well, I mean, that's for the media to do.
Right. So in other words, this is one of those rare occasions where attention is a sure sign that things are going to probably go wrong.
Well, could go wrong.
Could go wrong, but they're dodgy.
Yes.
Okay. So then after the elections,
there are a few further things. Now, you see, so you have long-term and short-term observers, they call them. So the long-term guys would come for sometimes for 3 months before.
Sure.
And then for 2 weeks for the short-term election themselves. And for the post-election, that could be something like 6 weeks or something. The announcement of the election, how did that happen? The acceptance of the result by all parties. And then the post-election review. And then how do they handle post-election disputes?
Uh-huh.
So that is, so that's the whole process. And this is all written by ISA. And any country that has elections, they send a box of these booklets to hand out. It's a very thin booklet to hand out to the observers and to hand out to people organizing the election to see this is the best way of organizing. Well, we have found it the best way, and you will find this happy and handy as well. But, you know, the thing about it, what elections have to do is to guarantee fundamental freedoms, human rights, to promote good governance and promote political stability. That's what these long-term observers are looking for, too. And all three of them are seriously looking for. They're looking at gender equality, and they're also looking at affirmative action. Are the small groups properly represented and able to get a piece of the pie, of an action?
Minority rights.
Yeah.
So, JJ, I mean, you've been in so many countries. So let's just look at a couple of these because I'm sure each of them has a fascinating story. But you've been to places as diverse as the Comores and the Congo, and that's just on the letter C. So where do we begin? And when was your most recent sojourn into one of these as an observer?
Egypt. Yeah.
Right. So let's start with Egypt.
Three times.
Because Egypt's gone through a lot of changes
I was there three times. I was there. But I wasn't there for LCC, but but Mohamed Morsi came in.
Yes.
And it was very interesting to see the Muslim Brotherhood and the similarities between the Muslim Brotherhood and the ANC in a way. You know, there was a sort of sense of entitlement. We will be the next government.
Oh, really?
Well, Mohamed Morsi won that election, to the best of my knowledge, sans doute. He won it.
Uh-huh.
But then Sisi came in and divested him of it and ran what was effectively a coup.
Yeah.
And then he came in, of course. He came in and ISA had a problem. You see what happens? There's an interesting part with this. With the election day comes, the announcement comes, and then there's a kind of race between the observation groups, like newspaper journalists wanting to be the first on. You want to be the first to put out your provisional findings. Your longer findings come out maybe 2 or 3 months later, but the provisional findings, yes. And they never, ever, we use the phrase free and fair. The election, I've never seen an election observation team that has said, these are free and fair elections. They've never used that phrase. They say, this is a proper reflection of the will of the people and things like that.
Oh, boy.
So it's journalese, free and fair.
Mm.
But we know exactly what it means. Interestingly, I found in Congo, was the first time that I'd had somebody walk past me. I was in a van with 2 or 3 other elections and pull his finger across his throat like that at me.
Really?
No, that was quite chilling.
What did you do to him?
I didn't do anything.
Why
I
did
was
he?
Sitting there,
he
I
just wanted to
there
take
wearing
you out.
Blue waistcoat and a blue cap showing I was an election observer. And I don't know what he'd had against election observers. But, you know, I just felt if I wasn't in the car, maybe he would have done it. The Comores, they didn't do anything wrong to me, but they did. They did some on the beach. I was waiting for the people to arrive, and at the time I was training, so I'd swim a mile across the bay and a mile back. You know, that would take me more than an hour in the water. And I said in my best French, "Est-ce qu'il y a le requin? Do you have sharks here?" And the guy said, "Mais non, monsieur, bien sûr, not at all." And I went every morning swimming 2 miles there and back. On the day that things were starting, I did it, got out just in time. And as I emerged from the water, this guy said, "Jesus, are you not scared of the sharks?" And I said, "But there are no sharks." And he said, "There's nothing but sharks." So there, that was it.
Wow. It wasn't the election that you should have been observing. It was the sharks in the bay.
Absolutely.
But the Comores, I mean, there's...
Well, I mean, the sharks at the polling station were probably more dangerous when you think about them.
But you couldn't get more different than the Comores and the Congo. I mean, you've got very small territory in the Comores, and it's easily traversable by boat or by car or whatever. The Congo, you've got this enormous span of land.
I was the first time I went, I think they sent me out to the east, you know, to Goma, to the border with Rwanda.
That's where all the difficulties
are. It was difficult. It was a very tough time. But that's what I chose. And it was another interesting thing. These various people belonged to parties, and they were working and observers just like me, and I would say, "Don't you want to come to the east with me? It's so interesting, very exciting." And this woman said to me, most pragmatic thing I've ever been to, she said, "You know what? I grew up in a shack, battling for every meal. I've had my share of discomfort. I'm going to stay at this 5-star hotel in Kinshasa, if you don't mind." But the Congo was very interesting. I remember, again, I was quite fit in those days. I was going for a run along the lake,
mm-hmm.
Lake Goma, Lake Kivu, sorry, Lake Kivu.
Yes.
And this guy stepped out with a rifle and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm just taking a bit of a run. Is that all right?" And he said, "In Rwanda, I'd crossed the border."
Oh, wow.
My life flashed before my eyes. And I said, "Well, I had no idea." And thank God he said to me, "The border's there." It was just maybe 100 meters. Turn around and go. And I ran back. It was speed work at that point. You know?
Wow. I mean, that's...
That was very lucky. And if that guy had held me, I could have been stone trouble.
Well, he could have shot you for crossing the border illegally.
Really? And there was no border, nothing. Because I was running along a path along the riverbank.
But it must be very difficult in a country like the Congo to actually get to the polling stations. For people to get to the polling stations, even in communities that are... You know, there are no roads in some parts of this.
The Congo is devoid of roads. But, you know, the places we went to, there was some South African peacekeepers that we saw at that part. They showed where one of the armored cars had gone down a hill and just ended up in the lake. And so, you know, there is that. And the driver we had was driving a bit fast, and a child ran out into the road, and he just missed the child. Luckily,
wow.
Because suddenly 20 people appeared around the vehicle and started giving this guy cane. And I said, drive. And we all said, we showed up out there. They didn't want to know anything.
No.
But we drove off. Nothing happened. There was interesting stuff. You know, one of the things is you have a little checkbook, a little checklist of things. You know, no. Were they kind to you? Did they give you coffee? No, that's not true. Did they give you coffee? No, they didn't. But you know, how many people in the polling station? Could they see? Were the ballots secret? Well, you know, how long were people taking to get to vote and so on? And one of the things, were there soldiers in the ballot, in the thing? And you had to say no. If there were soldiers, that was mentioned as part of the thing.
Of course.
But Egypt, for the second time, they had soldiers in the ballot stations, in the polling stations. And Egypt said, there's no way we're not going to have soldiers there because of our security situation. So we simply had to reflect that in our final report, that there were soldiers, which is, we don't smile on that. But, you know, this was the reason they gave and they do it. Madagascar was very interesting. You know, it's a lovely country, lovely people and so on. But what I found interesting was, you know, the counting where we were not allowed in Zimbabwe, not surprisingly. Where they count in Madagascar, they're in classrooms, school classrooms, and the windows absolutely jam-packed with people. And then the guy would take a ballot paper and say, "Monsieur Poulou, RDR," and then put it in there. But it took a time, and then "Monsieur Poulou," and they'd be cheering from the window. Yeah!
Must have been painstakingly long.
It took a hell of a long time.
Wow.
Know? But interestingly, Zimbabwe elections, when I say they didn't let voters in to for the counting process, and the counting process is absolutely transparent. That's where I learned the virtues of a head torch, because these people had little torches and candles. Finally, I had to give my head torch to the head of the counting section so that they could make some progress.
Wow.
You know, get through the night. But they wouldn't let us in. And the last time, ISA was not invited to the Zimbabwe election. Clearly, they have to be invited.
Was that in the Mugabe era? Or?
Certainly the Mugabe era, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've mentioned Zimbabwe now twice, and it does sound to me like that's probably the dodgiest one.
Yeah.
In terms of actually being able to say this was free and fair in any which way. Would you agree that that's probably the one that you think was the dodgy?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind that it was dodgy. And I've been a very young reporter in Zimbabwe, so I know this area was called Lake McIlwain. It's got another lake just outside of Harare, Salisbury, when I was there. And there was, as I say, many, many drink-related weekends there. And Lake McIlwain, and I knew the area quite well. And so I went there to look at polls. And I could see the ballot boxes absolutely filled. And when they were counting, the count was for the opposition, was for Morgan Tsvangirai. But when they were announced, the same thing were announced in Mugabe's favor. So that's how blatant they were. But that was the time before, so I was there for that. The next time, we were not invited, but we went nonetheless. We were there, and we went to the press conferences and that sort of thing. And then a guy, an official, claimed to know me and said to me, "You are a journalist about your business." So he might as well have said to me,
J'accuse,
you know, "You are a Western Province supporter and you eat really? Your young or something."
Did they want to throw you out?
Well, he knew that. And so I went to the head of the delegation and I said, "I'm sorry, but I've been recognized as a journalist." And, you know, they knew I was a journalist, but there wasn't, I hadn't, you know, my reports were just dead straight about what was happening. But I don't want to, and since you're not invited, that's it. So I got out that day, but I came back and I thought I'd go back into watch the election. You know, I wanted to see it. And I went back through the post, through the border post at
Bytebridge.
And there was somebody from my, in fact, it's, what's his name? He's with Carte Blanche now, and I'm just helping get him into Ukraine. Gavin Whittles.
Okay.
And he was waiting for me. I had a car, but he had a 702 car and was driving around Messina and Bytebridge. So somebody had seen him. So we went through, because you could get through as tourists, we went through as two tourists, and we got through, passport stamped, and we were just driving out of the customs area when bang on the car, and it was a cop, sent us back.
Oh.
And we were held for, about 20 hours or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but nothing happened. Well, they stole all my money.
Of course.
From the car, because I'd hidden it in the car. Then they'd gone through it. But I have to say, there's one particularly comic thing that I would hate to miss. Somaliland. Now, as you know, Somaliland, Ethiopia, Kenya, there is this weed that they chew. Cut. K-H-A-T.
That's right.
And it's a narcotic.
Hallucinogenic.
Hallucinogenic, yes. Yes. And they go through. And you go to, I know in Somaliland, they said you must never try and interview the president on a Tuesday because he chews on a Tuesday, you know. So it's accepted. And they used to, when Somaliland was in all kinds of economic trouble, but they used to fly the fresh cut in every day to the marketplace, you see.
The country needs it.
And the country needs it. So they were on rations for everything else, but the cut was there, and you drink tea with it because it's very bitter. But I got them, so everything was going well, and the election process was going very, very well. Somaliland compared to Somalia is a paragon of democracy. It was the third election I'd observed there, and this time we went to a polling station at just about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there was this guy looking at you.
He zonked.
Like, you know, like somebody that's on the cover of the Woodstock album.
He hadn't
He
hadn't been applying the rule of only chew on a Tuesday.
No, it was Tuesday. And I said, "Have you got enough voting material? You know, have you got enough ballot papers? Have you had enough? And have you got to all the things you need?" Then the guy next to him went, "Oh, no, we don't. How long have you not had these?" "Oh, it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon." "Oh, we ran out about 11 o'clock. You know." I said, "Wow. Well, what have you done? Have you called somebody?" "Oh, no, but no, we're going to." You know?
Yeah,
so
tomorrow.
These guys had been on cut.
Wow.
And many of them, you know, they'd been chewing cut and not really worrying about the election. The other thing in Somaliland was you had to dip your finger into the ink. It wasn't a wipe or something on the finger.
So your whole finger.
You had to dip your little finger in. And there were people, they filled trucks with people who had dipped their finger and then gone to the polling, another polling station and tried to vote again, you know, keeping their hand in their pocket and so on. So that kind of small-scale electoral fraud was happening, but it was comical at the time. But nevertheless, I think the elections were free and fair.
In Somaliland.
Yeah.
Now, what
most of the places I went to, they were. You know, you would count up, and then they would take the counting happens in the polling station. All right.
Yeah.
So that's to prevent you taking your box, filling it with stuff, giving it to somebody, and then going count somewhere else.
Right.
So you count, and I'm your opponent and your other opponents, and you have local election observers. They all there, and we are there. They count. Then they tally it all up, and if the tally doesn't make it, bugger that. You've got another hour and a half to do it over again. And that happened way too many times. But nevertheless, it has to tally exactly. And then you go and you put the result, paste the result on the outside of the polling station. And that's when, and now with the cell phones that just started coming in, or just pictures they would send, and they would send those. At the time, with the Zimbabwe one I mentioned at Lake McIlwain, they didn't have that. And they weren't published, they weren't posting the results right outside the polling station. So that's why they managed to cheat on that scale.
And they could crook it. Now, which of these elections that you have observed did you find to be the most surprising, efficient, fantastic, or the other way around?
Well, I have to say the one that surprised me pleasantly was the quick learning curve with the DRC. You know, with Mobutu Sese Seko being effectively a dictator all this time. No, democratic process. They picked it up very quickly. And by the second and third time I went for elections there, they really knew their score, you know, and they were very sophisticated in their outlook. But most interestingly, they learn very quickly. But you go through this fairly elaborate process. That still doesn't mean that you have a democracy. I think you could have elections in countries that we know are not democratic, where you would pass every one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's how, you know, they could cover on certain things or get a low mark on certain things, but they would still be the observers would have to say, well, these things do reflect the will of the people. But it's how, you know, and the frequency of elections is another thing. You know, you must make a decision on that. And, of course, the authority, in our case, the IEC, which, again, was an exemplary organization. The one in Zimbabwe is a complete mess. But generally, the electoral commissions have always been efficient. You know, they're answerable to parliament, and they've always done a fairly good job, and a fairly thankless job, too.
Yeah.
So there are many, many things. But at the end of the day, how the government treats its people once it's in power, and how the government, if it has a majority, actually takes account of the opposition. You know, I believe, for example, that if you have 66% or 70% power in a country, you don't have a democracy. You can't possibly have, because I come along with my 25%. I disagree with what you say.
And they just ignore you.
Yeah, I hear you, sure. Huh. Well, why don't you vote against me in Parliament? You know, that sort of thing. So if you don't take account of the will of the people, and then, you know, they did speak often in an African context, when you have a very close election, you're in a world of pain.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a, starting from village politics, 51% versus 49%, you have stone trouble until the next election.
Right.
You
know? I mean, we could be heading into one of those ourselves.
Could be. I'm hoping that we're going to have coalitions, because I believe in coalitions as a Democrat. But when you speak to a lot of people, they say we're not sophisticated enough and we will not be able to run coalition governments. I hope we will have coalitions, and I hope that we learn very quickly how to run them.
Well, I think that there are two really interesting observations. You said at the beginning of this that voter education is a big part of it, and that's what we're trying to achieve with Democracy 101. Is to get South Africans who are, you know, some young people particularly, very disenchanted with the whole process and find it to be boring and uninteresting, and they don't really have a dog in the fight, so they probably aren't that interested in voting. And we know voter registration for young people in this country is very low indeed. We're trying to help that along. But the other thing is this idea that democracy itself, the concept of democracy, is something sacred, and it's the best possible form of government, and that, you know, just as long as you pass the democracy test, everything will be sunshine and rainbows on the other side. We know that's not true.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
And Winston Churchill's quote about democracy is the, you know, worst form of government, but compared to all others, the others, it's probably okay. You know, the remarks he's made about democracy. And when you see democracy in action, you realize that. You know, I have to say, when I see our democracy in action, you know, from the counting and then the various things that I look for, I think we should be very, very proud of the democracy and the way it works here. It's pity you're not in another country, because you would get an honorable mention in the report with Politics 101, you know, as somebody,
we're trying to help.
An organization that has really worked at voter education.
Well, I think you've given us a great education, and there's still lots of stories that we didn't get to this morning. But you must check out Africa Analysis, if you haven't already, that JJ and I do every 2 weeks. And as an episode of Democracy 101, and with an election observer of 14 countries' experience, I hope that you are ready for the 29th of May here in South Africa. Thank you very much, JJ.
There we go.
Good to have you in. Thank you.